This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. I'm sitting here in Studio 3 for the show today, and I admit that I am wondering how long it'll take to get home tonight. Thanksgiving travel this year, expected to approach pre-pandemic levels. That's on top of daily commutes just shy of 2019 volumes, according to Highway Administrator Jonathan Gulliver. So in a moment, we will take your calls. If you are out there stuck in traffic today, does it feel like 2019? And what would need to change for you to ditch your car in favor of other ways of getting around? What would that change look like? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. First, though, we want to touch down at Logan Airport. The TSA expects passenger levels to hit about 88% of pre-pandemic numbers, and Logan expects almost 1 million people, or nearly so. We caught up a little earlier this afternoon with Ed Frenney, Director of Aviation at Massport, to hear what Logan's seeing right now.
So we are relatively busy. We are seeing the numbers strong as we expected. But when you compare to what we did in 2019, we're still down about 28% in the passenger side of the business. So over a 10-day period from last Friday, it's November 19th, through this coming Monday, November 29th, we expect to handle over 800,000 to 900,000 passengers in and out of Logan.
So that's down near still 30% from 2019. I'm wondering, you know, are the airlines and the airport ready to handle 2019-level traffic? We're aware of flight cancellations last month from Southwest and American. We know there are staffing shortages in a lot of industries.
Well, you asked about the airport. I think I can speak for the airport, and I can comment on the airlines. So the airport, we are ready. You know, we're nowhere near our capacity, and we're handling these numbers very, very manageably. TSA is well-staffed. We're well-staffed, and Mother Nature's complying, so that's been, really helpful. As far as the airlines are concerned, usually what we've seen in the past few months is they've struggled with in-flight staffing at the end of the month. So fortunately, the commitment to their schedule here at Logan, they've been able to staff properly, and we hope that continues right through the end of the month into December.
How's traffic getting in and out of the airport right now, Ed?
There is some construction on the roadways, so we would encourage people that have not been here in a while to go on our flylogan.com app, where you can take a look and see, you know, what the roadway conditions are. There are some detours, but as far as the traffic flow, it's been very smooth. There are periods during the early morning hours where it gets a little bit heavier, and then later on in the afternoon it gets heavy, but it's manageable.
So for some people headed to the airport, it could be the first time in more than a year and a half. What do they need to know before they show up and board?
Well, again, they could navigate their trip before they leave their home and go on the flylogan.com app, and you can find out a little bit more about the terminal you're going to, how to get there, what to expect when you get into the terminal. You can order food. You can also make a reservation to park here at the airport in advance when you go on the app. So there's a lot of real good, solid information that would help you if you haven't been here for a while.
What if people have forgotten, do I have to take my shoes off? Where do I put my mask on? What can I take through security? I remember the first time I got back on a flight after the start of the pandemic, there was a lot I just didn't remember, Ed.
Those are all TSA requirements, and you can get on their site, and the TSA.gov, I think it is. Things have changed as far as there's a lot of touchless opportunities now. Be prepared with your identification when you go through. Be prepared for what you might not be able to take or what you are taking. Put in your carry-on bag, and that will help the process. And believe me, I think, you know, we've seen the TSA has really stepped up their game over the last week or so, and through the period where we saw the numbers come back, and have done a great job. We have our own personnel out there trying to help people. So we'll assist in any way we can to make it a smooth transition through the process onto their flight.
And masks on at the airport, right, Ed?
It's a federal requirement to wear the mask when you get into the terminal, and it's also a federal requirement to have the mask on when you're in flight.
So by the end of August, the FAA had reported almost 4,000 reports of unruly behavior. What measures are in place at Logan to keep employees and passengers safe? Almost 3,000 of those reports were around refusing to comply with the mask mandate.
We have not seen that level of noncompliance. We've seen people come in here with masks. We're prepared to give them masks if they don't have them. So we haven't had it in the terminals, but we've had a number of times where we've responded to inbound airplanes, and you know, when the state police show up, everybody complies.
Any other advice for people traveling to or through Logan this weekend?
I think take a little bit more extra time, be patient, and it should be a real smooth situation for you.
Ed Frenney is Director of Aviation for Massport. Ed, thanks so much. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Take care.
That's Thanksgiving at Logan, so let's talk about our roads now. And we are taking your calls. If you're out there stuck in traffic today, does it feel like 2019 again? How about on a normal work day? And what would need to change for you to ditch your car in favor of other ways of getting around? What would that change look like? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And please, if you do decide to call us from your car, make sure you are doing so hands-free. With us to talk about solutions, Jim Aloisi, a former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and a board member of the group Transit Matters, which advocates for better, more reliable public transit, and Josh Ostroff, Interim Director of Transportation for Massachusetts, a nonprofit coalition dedicated to improving transportation across the Commonwealth. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Josh, thanks for joining us.
So great to be here.
So, Jim, before the pandemic, traffic in Boston was, by some measures, worst in the nation. Certainly we rank. If we're 93% of the way back to 2019 levels, that is a crisis. And I wonder, and Josh, I may come to you with this same question. Jim, what lessons did we fail to learn about traffic and transportation from the pandemic?
Well, it doesn't seem today that we learned many lessons well at all. The return of chronic traffic congestion is no surprise. And beyond the point of this being Thanksgiving holiday, everyone who drives in Metro Boston knows, if you have been driving, that congestion has returned. It's returned with a vengeance. And the patterns are even growing. So the time for congestion, traffic congestion, is extending in different times a day and in different places. We know that we need to invest in a better public transportation system so that some of those people, not all of them, but 10%, 15% of the people who really feel like they have no choice but to drive, would have a viable alternative on commuter rail or on the transit system, right? And so folks like me keep beating the drum, which is to say, if you really want to reduce traffic congestion, if you want to improve people's driving experience, you need to make a coordinated investment, stepping up that investment in public transportation. You need to provide people with better frequencies of service. You need to provide people with better, more reliable equipment. And you need to provide people with the connections that they make. It's so bad, Tatiana, that, and I like Ed, I know, I've known Ed Frenney for years. He's a very capable guy. It's not even in Massport's lexicon to talk about getting to Logan by public transportation, even though you can get there on the Blue Line and you can get there using the Silver Line. But no one thinks about it when it comes to state agencies asking people, how do you get here, right? It's all about the automobile. And unless that mentality changes, we're going to be stuck in the same old groundhog day of wringing our hands about traffic congestion while we know we have the solutions, but we're not doing what we need to do to make those things happen.
So, Josh, your organization represents a wide range of transportation-focused nonprofits and coalitions, et cetera. You know, as we've talked with Jim today and in the past, the emphasis is we got to just get cars off the road. There's nothing to do to the road that would reduce traffic. And we've heard that from a lot of experts. I want to check in with you. Is it about transit? Is it about alternate modes? Is there any investment we could or should be making to our vehicle infrastructure?
Well, thanks for those questions, and it's great to be on the line with Jim. Long time no see. Look forward to getting together in person. And to your listeners, I hope that they all have a great Thanksgiving holiday and get wherever they're going safely, or curl up on the couch with Netflix if that's their choice. So I think that one of the things we have learned from the pandemic is to more assertively rethink what public streets mean. And I just want to reflect for a second on an initiative at Mass DOT in many cities and towns, the Shared Streets and Spaces program, which provided money for quick build, quick turnaround projects to allow more creative uses of our public roads when fewer people were driving, but restaurants were struggling. We were able to provide outdoor seating or places for public art, you know, parklets and so on. And we were able to see that people actually do value roads for more than just a place to put your car, whether it's storing your car as a private parking space or you know, driving alone to work. So the potential is there. And then just recently, another leap forward with bus lanes, dedicated bus lanes in the city of Boston. All throughout the region, we've seen these bus and bike lanes spring up in the past couple of years, really fueled by cities and towns. But even MassDOT has gotten into it with a dedicated lane on the Tobin Bridge for buses, serving people who are the most transit dependent. So I believe these are solvable problems that, in addition to public transit incentives, we need better management of our public roads in order to move more people instead of just moving more cars. So our coalition really tries to focus on what human needs are and not just about moving someone's individual car, but a busload of people that could take 50 cars off the road.
Fair point. 800-423-8255. Rebecca in Sturbridge is on the line. Rebecca, go ahead.
Yes. Hi. I heard you asking about the traffic levels right now, and they are absolutely atrocious coming from the Boston area. I was working in Norwood today, and on the way home, it took me well over almost 3 hours to get home, and it usually takes about an hour. So I would definitely say there's a lot more travel than there was in the past couple of years, since 2019. I don't usually see this on your average day.
So Rebecca,
you know, or even holidays.
So two things. One, kudos to you for the cheery voice, despite what you just went through. And two, what would it take for you to ditch your car and get home a different way? What would need to be there?
Well, that's the thing. I live in a very cute little village that has no option for public transportation, and it's pretty much impossible to even get an Uber out there. So for me, I don't really have an option for public transportation. They would have to, Massachusetts would have to put public transportation in rural areas.
All right. Thank you, Rebecca.
For that to work.
Thank you so much. And thanks for the call. I'm going to grab Adam in Cambridge, too. Adam, go ahead.
Hi. I'm actually in traffic, and I would say it's worse than it was back in 2019. I'm going a direction I've never even gone before, thanks to Waze. The traffic's been horrible.
Adam, thanks for telling us that. I'm sorry about it. And I'm also struck by you talking about Waze, which really, 10 years ago when we were having traffic conversations, that wasn't even a part of it. We do, Jim Aloisi, have some new ways to kind of help us dodge traffic. But I'm particularly struck by what Rebecca was saying out in, you know, the western part of the state, where there's just zero alternative infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about the $9 billion coming in the infrastructure bill. Does it have actual promise? I mean, obviously, always $9 billion has promise, but actual promise for changes here?
Well, for Rebecca, who, you know, she describes she lives in a cute little village somewhere where she can't get an Uber, for folks like that, they've made a decision about where they want to live that requires them to drive, right? We there's very little that you can do that would pass any cost-benefit analysis to provide someone like her with the kind of public transportation alternatives that would help a larger number of people. But Adam from Cambridge, now, that's different, right? Cambridge, you've got the Red Line. Cambridge, you've got many bus lines. Cambridge, you've got really nicely protected cycling lanes. So if depending on where you live, the options to drive or not to drive become very quickly apparent. And what folks like me are saying is that hopefully with the new stepped up federal money, and there'll be about $2.5 billion over the next 5 years in additional capital funding for public transportation in Massachusetts, is that we can provide people with dedicated bus lanes. We can provide people with more frequent service on a regional rail system. We can provide people with electric locomotives rather than dirty, slow diesels. We can provide people with clean electric bus and find ways to move 10, 15% of people who may be driving to transit. You're not going to ever want to move 50 or 100% of the drivers to transit because no system can handle it, right? The goal ought to be to make driving easier for people who have to drive by moving more people from driving who can take public transit to transit. That's what we need to be focused on in Massachusetts.
Josh, does the legislature have that goal? I mean, the framing that Jim just gave us is very clean and addresses both Adam and Rebecca. What about our legislature? You know, I'm mindful of Shirley Leung's piece in the Boston Globe this week, criticizing them for going to recess without figuring out how to spend $4.5 billion in pandemic relief funds, which are supposed to address an emergency. Is there shared vision for the kind of solutions Jim's laying out?
Well, I try to keep my expectations in check with the legislature. And I think while they do work hard, we don't always see the benefit of that labor. The state Senate just did an extensive
process. I'm
sorry,
that was so diplomatic. Can we all just take a second to chuckle over the diplomacy of that line? All right, sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, I do care deeply for my friends in the legislature, but I would say, as a case in point, they just spent several months in the state Senate side of the building with a Reimagining Massachusetts report. We said after it was published and continue to be concerned that that needs to find its way into legislation. It was nowhere to be seen in the billions of dollars on spending ARPA. I want to point out, though, I don't think the legislature will have an extensive role in how we spend this new federal funding. Most of that is going to come through separate funding streams that are done by metropolitan planning organizations in Boston, Springfield, elsewhere around the state. And then some will be subject to competitive grants. I want to pick up on one thing that Jim said with dedicated bus lane for Rebecca from Sturbridge. The idea that we actually don't have a dedicated bus lane on the Mass Pike is sending a signal. And we send these signals all the time to motorists, keep driving. And what we have now with congestion on our roads, whether it's our highways going across the state or city streets, we seem to be sending signals to people to drive by what we charge people to drive, to use a scarce resource such as a public street, what we charge them for gas tax compared to the cost of public transportation. This message we're sending is the wrong one. And it really comes home when we talk about climate impacts and public health.
Yeah, let's pick up on that. Sorry.
Sure.
So to you, Josh, I'll let you finish your sentence and we'll go to Jim. Public health and equity. Right? What we need to do for equity. Go ahead.
Right. So I think that we are not giving people the right message if we are serious about reducing carbon emissions. And the state has set very high goals, but we aren't doing enough to achieve them through carbon emissions reduction from the transportation sector, which is the largest source of carbon emissions and tailpipe pollution, which impacts people who have the misfortune of living and working next to congested highways, so they bear the burden of transportation emissions and aren't able to participate in the economic recovery as much as we would like. So that's a concern for our coalition. I'm sure Jim shares this. I've heard him talk about it many times.
Yep, Jim, we've got about a minute left, so just a couple thoughts there.
Well, it'll be a piece that I just wrote for Commonwealth Magazine. I expect it'll be out next week where I talk about this issue. And Massachusetts does not have a credible plan at this point, remarkably, to reduce carbon emissions from the transportation sector. Our state plan, if you can believe it, basically wants to put everybody in an electric vehicle by the year 2050. I don't know that that's realistic or achievable, but even if it were to be, there's nothing in the plan that deals with some of the equity issues that are involved, right? People who can't afford to buy a car, people who live in places like East Boston with triple deckers who don't have driveways or garages to park a car and charge it in. We've got a long way to go in Massachusetts to bring decarbonization equity to the forefront. And I'm looking forward to having that debate in a robust way in the new year.
Oh, let's do that. All right. That is Jim Aloisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and a board member of the group Transit Matters. Jim, thanks.
Thank you.
And Josh Ostroff, Interim Director of Transportation for Massachusetts, a nonprofit coalition. Josh, thank you to you too.
Always glad to be here. Thank you so much.
You might have turkey on the brain, especially if you are stuck in traffic. But for small business owners, getting back into the black is top of mind. And with Black Friday looming, with Target declaring it's done opening on Thanksgiving, and the competition for dollars fierce, we want to check in with local retailers. Now, in a few minutes, we will take your calls. Will you be camping out in front of the big box stores? Maybe you're committed to shopping locally. Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. First, Yasmeen Ammer, WBUR's business reporter, joins us. Let's check in. Welcome back, Yasmeen.
Hi, Tiziana. Thank you for having me.
So you've been out and about today talking to businesses. What are you hearing?
I came out with two main takeaways after speaking to several business owners. They tell me that people have been shopping early. That message has been really getting out there, a push to go ahead and get your stuff, because the longer you wait, the longer you risk shipping delays or a lack of inventory. And because people have been shopping early, these brick and mortar stores have been seeing more foot traffic. And because of that, they are feeling more hopeful. I definitely felt a sense of optimism, because it just feels like a signs of a comeback. So that's like Brooke Garber. She owns the clothing boutique Mint Julep. It has locations in Cambridge and Brookline.
So we're excited about this holiday because this year people have a reason to buy something other than sweatpants and a sweatshirt. People are coming in and they're excited about getting dressed. They're excited about their holiday parties. And it's nice to be able to sell sparkles and dresses and to see people excited and optimistic.
I think we could all use a little more sparkle in our wardrobe, even if it's still on Zoom. So that's a nice hopeful sign.
Yeah, I'm going to go home and find something sparkly. It's actually a fun idea.
Please okay. do.
That's yes. right. So we talked to John Hurst, who's the president of the Retailers Association of Massachusetts, earlier today, just in general about how retailers are faring. I want to play you some of what he told us.
Just within our membership, we lost, of our 4,000 members, we lost probably about 8%. Ultimately, you know, closed their doors. You know, there's no question that there was a shakeout of both stores and restaurants across the Commonwealth. And they're still in a very fragile state. This holiday season is going to be very important because so many of them have not gotten back to profitability yet. Their costs are up, yet their sales have not really recovered to the level that they really need to cover those increased costs. And, you know, those that do not have a good holiday season, it's very possible we'll see some more close their doors after they close the books on 2021.
That kind of makes my heart clench, Yasmeen, for business owners. Does it match what you're hearing from people?
So I did mention there is optimism, but really some businesses are, to be honest, still hanging on by a thread. I spoke to Stephen Adelson. He's the owner of Teddy Shoes in Cambridge. That is a legacy business. They've been around since 1957, if you can believe it. They sell shoes, dance gear, leotards, tights, all kinds of accessories. And to be honest, the pandemic hit them hard.
It's been very difficult. Our sales were down 90%. We launched a GoFundMe campaign, which is still active, and we're grateful for the support. We're hopeful that we'll continue. We're working hard to make our business become more available and more known to the general public.
And so what he means by more known to the general public is that he's relying on new ways of getting new shoppers. You know, before he had these longstanding relationships with dance studios, he still has those, but a lot of those dance studios did close during the pandemic and remained closed. So he's trying, you know, he has a website now, he has online retail, some digital marketing. I spoke to John Hurst, the head of the Retail Association, myself, and he told me that 2 years ago, 26% of his members had online shopping in addition to brick and mortar. Now that number is more than 60%. That is a huge jump. And the business owners I spoke to say the pandemic has really pushed them to think more digitally for survival. They had to. But whether it's digital or brick and mortar, more than anything, and for Adelson, it's really about reminding people that his business is still here.
So before I bring in another voice, I want to ask Small Business Saturday. Also this week, tell us what it is, how much it helps local retailers with holiday sales, how important it is.
So Small Business Saturday is something that, you know, in this evolution of, you know, Black Friday, then Cyber Monday, Giving Tuesday, you know, Small Business Saturday is this kind of, I don't want to say pseudo holiday, maybe it's official, but it is a focus on small businesses, and it's a way to remind people, for local communities, to remind people to shop local. And all of these initiatives are very collectively important, but it's not like Small Business Saturdays is going to make or break these businesses that I talk to necessarily. The thing about small businesses, they are small, and that means they have small marketing budgets. And so they really need as much marketing as possible, and this helps them. I spoke to Maria Vasco about that. She owns a zero waste store in the North End. So it sells all sorts of plastic-free home and self-care products. And she actually opened her store during the pandemic. And she says by far, her biggest challenge is not staffing or inventory. It's spreading the word.
Since we are small, we don't have like the huge budget to spend thousands of dollars in ads. We don't have like the budget to, you know, have a billboard on a highway. So we really have to focus on organic growth. We have to focus on good customer experience and word of mouth in order to grow. And it's been really effective.
So things like Small Business Saturday could help with that. Vasco tells me that she's also been using TikTok to advertise. So that does well for her because she's reaching out to this younger, more sustainably focused audience. And of course, I love TikTok so much. So it makes me really happy to hear that.
All right. So Yasmin, stand by. I'm going to take a call and then bring in another voice. I will come back to you. Thanks. 800-423-8255. We've got Betsy on the line in Somerville. Betsy, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I think the point about Small Business Saturdays is so important. And I actually try to follow that mantra year round and try to shop locally whenever I can. And on Black Friday, my husband and I are at his parents in Connecticut, and there's nothing but mall and big box stores nearby. And so this year, I'm going to be really conscious to go online, see what emails I get and what small businesses around me are doing for sales, and try to support them by making purchases even online on Friday, and then also going Saturday and beyond Small Business Saturday to support locally owned businesses.
Thanks for the call to action, Betsy. And I'm sure the voice I'm going to add here, Dave Sikowski, likes to hear that. Dave owns Magpie and Magpie Kids, clothing and gift stores, Porter Square, Davis Square. Joins us on the road from New York. Dave, that's good of you. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us en route. You could have done both of our segments. We had a traffic segment, too. So let me ask you, Dave, how important is this next chunk of time to your business, these next few weeks?
Very important. As most retailers, not just small retailers, we do the majority of our business in December every year. There's many months of the year where we're in the red, and, kind of this last month of the year, the push for the holidays is really what keeps us going every year. And, Small Business Saturday, it's a nice thing, but yeah, as was said earlier, it's not a make or break thing for us. We found in the past that actually sort of local organizations such as Somerville Local First or even Cambridge Local First, when they do shopping events in December, usually like in the evening or on a weekend, I know there's lots of these events around. Inman Square has done a few, and those really help because the local government, like the Somerville, City of Somerville, has a bigger budget and a more of a reach to let people know, that this thing is happening in Davis Square or in Porter Square. And those really help.
So, Yasmin played a sound from a local business owner saying, what we don't have is the budget to get the word out. It sounds like you're saying that's where your city government, your local community, your local business district, et cetera, can really help you, is getting the word out this time of year to people to find your business.
Yeah, yeah. In Davis Square, we've actually, myself and some of the other businesses, D Squared and Kamikaze and the Boston Shaker, we've gotten together in the past and done our own marketing for, pooled our money and printed flyers for an event we do every year called Midnight Madness. We haven't picked a date yet, but it's going to be a Thursday in December. We do it every year.
We actually are going to have a segment later this week from the Boston Shaker. It's funny that you mentioned them today. You know, you said, your answer to my first question, you said, you know, the majority of your business between now and the end of the year. What does that mean? Is that 50%? Is that 80%? I mean, for people who don't know what it feels like to be you, how much will you be sweating bullets between now and January 1st?
A lot. We're sweating many bullets. You know, I would say a good 50% of your business is this last month. But you know, it's not a, but again, it's like, if it's a bad year, you just keep going. You know, I don't think anyone gets in this to become rich or, you know, we do it cause we love it, cause we love the local community. We love talking to people, meeting customers. We love, you know, for me, I love finding cool, unique products and local artisans to work with. And so, you know, if you just keep trudging along, you keep doing it. And, you know, Somerville and Cambridge, they're great. The community has been so wonderful and they're so supportive. And, you know, Magpie's been in business since 2004. You know, we've seen some lean years. 2008 was really rough. And obviously the last couple of years, the last year was rough with COVID, but, you know, we'll keep going, you know, as long as we have the support of our community.
So, Dave, stay with us. Yasmin Ammer, who is WBUR's business reporter, is also with us. I want to bring Yasmin back in here because, Yasmin, I'm really struck by that joy, right? That love of customers, of community. It's not a commerce message we're hearing from Dave here. It's something more. And I wonder how that resonates with you as you're talking to other small business owners right now.
It resonates a lot because it's funny. I hear that community line a lot from local business owners. None of the people I spoke to are getting like massively wealthy off of their business, but they really like being there and they really like having people walk into their store and they really like having repeat customers. Like they mentioned, people stick with them. The fact that people stick with them, even when they move out, some people come back, some people like use the online shopping to stay in touch with them. And it just seems like a really important part of having a local business.
So Dave, hearing Yasmin there, it raises another question that I wanted to ask you, which is for you, hearing that it's not just sales, right? I guess I'm assuming that you'd prefer to make that sale in the store versus online, even though, as I understand it, you actually pivoted pretty well to online during the pandemic. Can you talk about that a little bit? The difference between in-store sales and online sales for you?
Sure. Yeah. We definitely did pivot. And we put our inventories online at the beginning of the pandemic. We worked hard and got everything online. And in the beginning, when the stores were closed because of the COVID restrictions, we did a lot of online business, you know, and a lot of curbside pickup and things like that. And it's not as fulfilling. You know, it's nice to know that your customers are still sticking with you and buying things online, and you would get some emails from people saying they appreciated it and things like that. But yeah, the human interaction of seeing people in the stores, you miss that. I mean, I could open an online store or an Amazon store. That's all I wanted. But, you know, I think myself and the other business owners I know in the area, you know, we thrive on the interaction. Yasmin just mentioned customers coming back even if they move away. That happens all the time. It happened just the other day. A woman came in and she said, I moved to Seattle about 10 years ago, but every time I come back to visit, I try to come back here and buy some presents. And it's heartwarming to hear people say that, you know.
So the other question I want to ask you, you talked at the beginning about one of the joys is finding that product or that toy or that local vendor. I thought it would be kind of fun for you to tell us about one that you found that just really caught your fancy, that you were excited to put in your store or bring to your customers.
Oh, you're putting me on the spot.
I am.
I mean, there's just so many over the years. You know, I mean, the things I love is just when people come in, you know, they walk off the street and they say, you know, I started making jewelry. Would you be interested in carrying it? And we, you know, we're like, yeah, sure. Bring it on in. They bring it in. We start carrying it. And, you know, and then it goes on for years and it's just a great relationship. Right now, we have jewelry, for example, a woman named Heather, who actually is the manager Cafe Zing in Porter Square. We sell her jewelry, and, you know, that's a nice symbiotic relationship. She works at another small business, a coffee shop in the Porter Square bookstore, and we sell her jewelry, and we've been selling it for a few years. And we just, it's really nice. That's the other thing about you. It's nice to have customer relationships, but it's also very nice to have vendor relationships. And, you know, the vendors are, they're not, you know, hitting it rich either. They're doing it because they love it, because they love to make things that make people happy, you know, to, so.
Well, that's Dave Sikowski, who owns Magpie and Magpie Kids, clothing and gift stores in Somerville. I know you're en route to New York. Thanks so much for joining us. And
oh,
we
sure.
Wish you,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, and good luck these next few weeks.
Thank you.
So, Yasmin Ammer, I want to ask you, Dave was talking about the business relationships, the vendor relationships. I love the joy he brought to this conversation. I am also mindful of the mechanics of supply chains and labor shortages. So, let's get unjoyous again for a minute and tell us a little bit about how that's affecting local businesses here.
I mean, it's not totally unjoyous. It is a mix out there. For a lot of people that I spoke to, their business is very small. And so it's the owner and maybe one other person who are running the show. But I have seen a lot of help wanted signs, particularly at bigger stores. So my local electronics store, for example, so busy, and they've been looking for people since the beginning of this year. And of course, bigger department stores. And it's really a lot of the businesses that typically benefit from foot traffic who are hurting. So think restaurants and coffee shops, even grocery stores. A lot of people quit in the food industry. The head of the restaurant association estimated that about like a third of his members are gone. So we just know those businesses are going to continue feeling that labor shortage as well. But do keep in mind, a lot of the businesses I spoke to just in the greater Boston area have the added benefit of being around colleges. And so while a lot of those students are home, they are taking up like part-time holiday work. So that is helping in this specific locality.
And hard clock here. So in a sentence or two, what are you going to be watching for next?
So I this feels kind of more like a coming out or a reemergence for small businesses. It's not really like a make or break it, like I said. It's just like their way of saying, hey, I'm still here. I survived this really horrible thing. Please keep us in mind. So I'm really curious about the sustainability of this like focus on local businesses.
All right, WBUR business reporter Yasmin Ammer, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
We want to close the show today at the foot of Mount Monadnock, which inspired the setting for a story about the end of the world, one that's quiet and lush and eerily serene. That's how author Andrew Krivak pictures it in his novel The Bear, published in February 2020. It centers a man and his daughter, the last two humans on Earth, living along a lake at the edge of the mountain that stands alone and grappling with essential questions of humanity and legacy. Just last week, The Bear won a Massachusetts Book Award for fiction. Last year, we brought you a journey that Radio Boston's Chris Siderick took with Andrew Krivak, visiting him at his Jaffrey, New Hampshire home and hiking up Mount Monadnock. We thought we'd bring it to you again today.
Okay. I just see the summit right up there?
Look at that, yeah.
You see that?
That's Andrew pointing through the thick gray clouds gliding across the jagged rocky Monadnock summit. You couldn't quite see the top of the mountain from his front yard, but luckily for me, Andrew was kind enough to row us out into the middle of Thorndike Pond to preview our ascent.
And when we go up there, those rocky ledges, you can just see, you'll see the pond, you'll see the roof of the house, and then as you drop down that saddle and head towards the summit, you lose it. You can just see the pond where we are now.
Yeah.
But everything else disappears. It's so cool.
I could have floated on the still, tranquil water all day. But we had a long walk ahead of us, and it was time to get started.
Pop that bumper out, which is just push it overboard. There we go. I want you to get out first.
What had brought me here to climb this mountain with Andrew was an absolute gut punch from his book. A question I just couldn't shake. How do I give my kids what they need to continue their journey, even after I'm no longer here to hold their hands and walk by their side? As Andrew and I began our climb, he told me that despite the big and sometimes heavy themes of the book, the novel was actually born out of a bedtime story.
So that's how it all began.
Yeah.
On the fly. Totally exhausted parent trying to come up with a story.
So. I have no idea what that feels like.
I know you know.
Over time, the story evolved. Andrew changed the main characters from a man and his son to a man and his daughter, but it still didn't feel quite right. And then one day, he was out in the middle of Thorndike Pond feeling like the only person left in the world.
And then I was out fishing one day and just looking around and thinking, what's it going to be like for the last two? And I thought, that's it. It's got to be the last two. That's the crux of the narrative.
After that, the rest of the pieces began to fall into place.
Once I realized it was the last two, I thought theologically it would be really interesting if the creation myth gives us the man first. The other side of that myth, it'd be fitting if a woman were last.
So he's created a story to bookend Adam and Eve. But for Andrew, humans are just one part of that story. Nature, which he calls the first actor, is the real protagonist. And he worries that sometimes people put so much emphasis on progress, our species' steady march forward, that we lose sight of our connection with the natural world.
And then forgetting that we've created a distance with nature.
That we just kind of accept it as the status quo?
The way it's got to be. And not only just accept it as status quo and say, oh, isn't that terrible, but really, in some corners, just really thinking this is precisely the way it ought to be. We ought to be as far away from it as possible so that our lives can be better, easier, healthier, you know.
Even the word civilized kind of...
More civilized, exactly. Yeah. Right.
As we got closer to the summit, the trees became thinner and shorter, giving way to the broad, flat boulders that topped the mountain. We made our way out onto an open rocky ledge at the foot of the summit, a place strikingly similar to one of the most powerful moments in the book, when the man takes the girl to see where her mother is buried.
Behind it was only sky, so that in profile the shape of that summit looked to her, too, like the head of a bear staring into the blue. And off to the side, as though on a shoulder of that head, she saw a cairn of rocks, on top of which was placed a large flat stone. She could feel her sweat cool as the wind pushed against her arms and chest, looked over at her father and pointed to the pile. He nodded, and they made those last strides together.
Those last strides together. So much of the book's power comes from what every parent knows, that someday we'll no longer be here, and our children will have to walk their own paths.
It's not my job to make them anything other than who they are. You know, it's my job not to get in their way. So, I think about my parents as well. I didn't realize this until my father had passed away, that he did a great job of never putting an obstacle in my way. And I am who I am as a result of it.
Sitting there on that rocky ledge, thousands of feet above the pond where we started, I thought about how, as a father of two boys, I feel that constant tension between this responsibility to prepare them to continue on after I'm gone, and at the same time, an overwhelming desire to shelter and protect them from a world that can be harsh and ugly. I asked Andrew how he thought about that struggle as a father himself as he was writing the story.
Yeah, great question. I thought about it a lot, pretty much every time I sat down to write on the page. When the man is at the beach and he's looking out at the horizon and he's saying to no one, to everything and nothing, she's not ready yet. It's that tension of, I know I'm going to go, and she'll never be ready as far as I'm concerned, but he can't write her story for her.
As we began our descent, I asked Andrew, you wrote this book before the pandemic. If you were writing it today, would you change anything? And he surprised me when he said, no.
It's not about climate change. It's not about pandemics. It's not about human extinction. It's about a man who's heard stories telling stories to his daughter, who finds a way to keep listening to stories and finds a way in which stories are told in ways other than her father told her.
You said kind of early on in the trail that, you know, that in this moment we're living, that someone will tell this story someday.
Yeah.
What do you think that's going to look like?
Yeah. I don't know. And that's funny. We're, you know, they talk about a beginning, a middle, and an end of story. We're right in the middle.
Yeah.
And who knows how the end goes? Someone's got to tell it. But I think about that a lot. And I also think that it's not our time yet to tell it to the end. Our time is now to live in it. We are in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's scary, exciting, beautiful, real, all those things.
Andrew sees humanity as part of a middle, too. The Earth was here long before us, and it will outlast us. Back on the shore of Thorndike Pond, where we started our journey, Andrew read an excerpt from the end of his story, a bear's reflection on the world after the last human has left this great green earth.
It had been night a long time when he emerged from the trees and lumbered into the clearing beneath a waning moon. He waded into the lake, drank, and came out, sat in the high grass and looked up at the stars. He felt the fatigue of his task as though he had come to a place where end and beginning were the same. And in the time he'd spent on that mountain, everything had changed. He lifted his ears to listen and heard nothing. No steps of animals, no whisper of trees, no snap of insects, no lapping waves. A silence as cold and strange to him as winter. He wondered how long he had been sitting there, if for just a moment the earth stood still, when the leaves of the forest began to rustle, and the ghostly wail of a loon floated across the surface of the water. He rose and stretched and turned, so that the great bear was over his right shoulder. Then he set out, moving west along the shore, the sky beginning to pale behind him, like the world itself being born.
So that's, you're talking about the ending, the end of humanity, but it's almost happy.
Well, yeah. I think what I was imagining was a way in which we could think about the existence of humanity as something that's part of stories. The flesh, as it were, dies. There are no more humans. But the story of humans is captured and lives on in here, in nature, in the animals, in the trees, in the very, you know, very water we've just been over. And to me, that seemed okay. You know, maybe that's what we need to think about if there's a sense of what's the climate mean to us? What does the environment mean to us? We should sort of let go of the hubris that we are the beginning and the end, and just think of ourselves as part of the middle.
That was Radio Boston's Chris Siderick speaking with author Andrew Krivak last year about his novel The Bear, which just won the Massachusetts Book Award for Fiction. That's our show for today. Tomorrow's Thanksgiving, however you will be spending the day tomorrow. On behalf of everyone here at Radio Boston, we wish you peace and happiness. Thanks for listening. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.